Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine just what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have on the line with us Garland Favorito, and I read many of his articles. He writes very frequently on the Internet, and I usually agree exactly with everything he's saying, but he had an article recently talking about what had happened at 9-1-1. And, of course, the FBI's response to this whole situation. Now, we're told that, of course, we had total incompoops in the FBI. People were totally inadequate, didn't know what they were doing. They had the supervisor in Washington, D.C., who just couldn't connect the dots between what was happening up in Minnesota with Zacharias Massui, who was training how to fly a plane, but he didn't want to know how to land it. He just wanted to fly it, and the flight instructor figure he was going to be a suicide bomber. And the FBI agents up there figured he was going to be a suicide bomber, and they wanted to get into his computer, and the people in Washington, D.C. didn't want to get into that computer. And then, of course, the same supervisor had gotten the information from the Phoenix memo sent out of Phoenix, Arizona, pointing out that there were so many young Islamic people learning how to fly, and they were concerned that they might be used for terrorist purposes. And the supervisor had no idea what it was going. He was totally incompetent, and he was probably the one who certainly prevented people from in Washington, D.C. becoming aware. And, well, what happened to that man? Garland, whatever happened to that fellow at the FBI headquarters who dropped the ball probably as much as anybody responsible for putting everybody to sleep and not knowing what happened? What happened to him, Garland?
Presidential Meritus Rank Award and a 20% plus pay increase.
In other words, he was rewarded for his incompetence. But, of course, they're really not telling you the truth, because I personally talked to the head of the Airman School, the Airman's Flight School in Norman, Oklahoma, who told me that 11 to 12 days before 9-1-1, before the attack, they were there checking with her on Zacharias Massui. So they recognized what this was all about. But they can't let the American people know, because think of the implications. 3,000 people died. But, of course, if you look upon this as the fact that we had to have an incident, a catastrophic and catalyzing event to get the American people willing to go to war, then this was a great success, and you would reward the people in Washington, D.C. But where is the outcry from the average American? Where is even the outcry from the average family victim? Well, they've all been paid off. We didn't pay off the people, the families of the people who were killed in the Oklahoma City bombing, but we paid off the people, the families of the people who were killed in Washington, in New York City, with $2 million, large sums of money, as long as they would promise just to not to bring any lawsuits, not to make any waves, just go on with your life. Was that compassion? Or was it a conscious effort to cover up from the American people the fact we've launched on a world empire, we've launched on a World War III, and we had to get into it? There was an urgency, it almost seems terrible urgency about this, because, of course, it's going to change America forever. And Garland has pointed out in his articles, so many people in government within the FBI who should have been either sacked or fired or tried for incompetence were actually promoted and rewarded. And we're going to be back here in just a moment with Garland, and we're going to hear his analysis of what happened following the 9-1-1 attack. Why would they promote and reward the people in the FBI? Well, Garland, pick up the story from there.
Well, Dr. Stan, you have said that so eloquently, I can hardly expound on it much, but as you have explained, there were, I'll go a little bit deeper, there were four FBI investigations going on. One was in Chicago with Robert Wright, and he was a special agent there. And he had assistance from the Justice Department. He was investigating money laundering by Saudi Arabian businessmen. And he said they believed that that was, that money was used for terrorist activities. His investigation was shut down, by the U.S. Justice Department. And, he also received no help from a certain, group in headquarters, that worked for the FBI.
In other words, they actually shut him down. He was trying to investigate the Saudi financing of a lot of terrorism. Was that it?
That's exactly right. That was one of the four investigations. He was out of Chicago, and he eventually went public, and Judicial Watch actually brought a suit, or helped him bring a suit against the U.S. government. I think it's still pending at this time. And then another investigation that was going on was... the famous Ken Williams memo that was written from Phoenix, Arizona, back to headquarters. That was explaining how the I guess it was Hanji Hanjour, one of the alleged hijackers, was out and gained flight training, and they suggested that we should be looking into all of these people who are getting flight training. Very suspicious activities from people who are in the country and wanting to fly these planes that they're not qualified for, 747s and so on. So Ken Williams wrote a memo back to a certain area in FBI headquarters. And then there was, you've already mentioned, the investigation in Minnesota with Zacharias. I can't talk tonight. Masali. And he was also being investigated, same kind of thing. Colleen Rowley, the FBI legal general counsel there, wrote a memo back to try to get an investigation on him going, and she wanted to do what they call the FISA application, which is called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and they wanted to get a warrant to investigate him based on that act. And that went back to the same area in FBI headquarters.
Hold that thought there for just a minute, sure. Garland, when we bring our other stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Garland, I was just talking about, there were four investigations that were going on in the FBI. One of them was a Mr. Wright, who was in Chicago. He was an FBI agent there, was investigating the Saudi financing of terrorism, and the FBI shut that investigation down. Now, why would you shut down an investigation of the Saudi Arabian financing of terrorism here in the United States and throughout the world? And then, of course, there was the so-called Williams, Ken Williams, a directive that went from Phoenix, suggesting that a lot of young Islamic people were training for flying, and there was a question they might be being used for hijacking or suicide bombers. And then there was the investigation up in Minnesota under Colleen Rowley there, and of course they wanted to be able to get into Masui's computer, and certainly there was no reason why they shouldn't have been allowed to. Actually, they had the information from the French, who said, this man's a terrorist. The French intelligence shared the information. They knew he was part of this Islamic terrorist movement, and the folks in Washington, D.C. said, oh, no, we can't interfere with his constitutional rights. Here's a guy who's in America illegally. He's an Islamic terrorist, and they're talking about constitutional rights. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a cover. They knew the attack was coming. They were monitoring them. In fact, the reason Massawi has not been put on trial is because he keeps saying, I was monitored. They monitored me every moment I was here in the United States. I wonder how many Americans know that the man named Nicholas Berg, the one we saw pictures of her, who was decapitated, we saw pictures of him. He was decapitated supposedly by the Muslims over in Iraq, by the Muslim terrorists. But what's so very interesting, when the pictures we saw, he was wearing an American jumpsuit, an orange jumpsuit. You remember those pictures? I wonder how many Muslim terrorist groups carry standard American orange jumpsuits around them so they can put their prisoners into those. Well, Nicholas Berg was obviously working for the CIA or something, because he had contact with Massoui when they were in Norman, Oklahoma together. What do you think that chances are that that would happen just by accident? And then after being in contact with Massoui, who has said, I was being watched by the government all the time I was in the United States. Then, of course, Berg goes over to sell cell phones in war-torn Iraq. Do you honestly believe that? Where is he getting the money? To spend many months there, he's arrested by the Iraqi police, turned over to the American police, and then released, and suddenly we see pictures of him in an orange official army issue prisoner jumpsuit, and very soon he's decapitated. Was it really the Muslims did it, or did Nicholas Berg know too much about what's going on? And you may say, that sounds like why the ravings of a madman, but if what I say is true, and those of you who remember the pictures on television, remember him in the orange jumpsuit, why didn't the media point out and really emphasize the point there was a relationship between Zacharias Massoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, and Nicholas Berg, who was executed over in Iraq after being there for many months, selling cell phones in the middle of a war-torn country? What's wrong with this story? Well, if you believe that, you probably believe that we had no idea there was going to be an attack on America. And all the FBI agents who contacted David Shippers and my friend Dr. Garth Nicholson, and the people who contacted Willie Brown the night before, the mayor of San Francisco, the night before the attack, and told him to be very careful flying the next day, you probably believe that none of those things happened, that it all simply the ravings of people who believe in black helicopters. Go ahead, Garland.
And, of course, Dr. Stein, just to add to your description there, and in the case of the Nicholas Berg photograph, there were quite a few discrepancies in addition to the orange jumpsuit, the fact that he was sitting in a Western-style chair.
Isn't that standard issue for Muslim terrorists?
And then the Muslim terrorists are supposedly, as we call them, they're Arab terrorists, but they had a type of Western garb on themselves. As I recall the pictures, there, some of them were wearing American or Western-made tennis shoes. They had Western wedding bands on, very light-skinned, not dark. So those was a whole slew of discrepancies in those pictures, in addition to the orange jumpsuit.
Of course, as I remember, they were wearing some sort of face mask. We could just see sort of the eyes and, you know, the foreheads, things like that.
Right. Of course, but that's exactly right. Of course, the skin on the arms and so on. The whole thing looks just so very, very suspicious.
Right.
That was very unusual. And going back to the investigations, probably the fourth investigation that we didn't talk about yet, which probably is the most amazing to me of all, is the one out in San Diego, where we find out that the FBI actually had an informant who hosted two of the alleged hijackers for several months, less than a year before 9/11. This was in the period of approximately September 2000 to December 2000. And these two alleged hijackers, Al-Hazami and Mihar, were actually living with an FBI informant in San Diego, California.
And, of course, they were being funded by the wife of the Saudi Arabian ambassador in Washington, D.C. And, of course, the CIA had known that these were terrorists. They had been following them overseas. But when they got to the United States, they couldn't find them, although they were listed in the telephone book. They used their own names when they got on the plane. But the CIA just couldn't find them. The FBI couldn't find them. Oh, shucks, we've got such bumbling idiots in government. How do we possibly, within 24 hours, know who all the people were, have pictures of them, the whole history of their lives, the record of everything they did in the United States, pictures of them drawing money out of ATM machines 6 or 8 months beforehand? How did they get all that information so quickly? It's really amazing how efficient they immediately became, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And in fact, the CIA went so far as to fail on purpose not to warn the State Department and put these two on the State Department watch list when they entered the United States.
In fact, they didn't put the terrorists on there. They put patriots, and several of my friends are on those watch lists. What's the crime? Why, they love America. That, of course, is something that can't be tolerated, but we don't want to put the terrorists on there because why? That one might be called racial profiling.
Exactly. And that's the excuse that they use. But I thought this was probably the most intriguing of all. But all of these four investigations all basically were sabotaged by just a very small handful of people at headquarters in Washington, D.C., for the FBI. And this is kind of gets to the point that you were making, Dr. Stan, about, well, you have to think that there was this grand conspiracy with thousands of people involved, and the FBI, all these field investigations had to be shut down, so all these people in the FBI were all in on this 9/11. Well, no, not at all. There only had to be two or three people at FBI headquarters to shut down all of the field investigations that could have prevented 9/11.
But the thing is that they promoted and rewarded, gave financial rewards to these people. How many people were fired or disciplined for their failures to prevent the deaths of 3,000 Americans?
Exactly. And as you know, in business, you are promoted and rewarded if you carry out the will of your superiors. That is why you're promoted and rewarded. So these individuals who were at FBI headquarters, who shut down these investigations, actually more than one, there's actually two or three, they were promoted, and therefore they must have been carrying out the will of their superiors to prevent 9/11 from being stopped by all these wonderful people in the field who had worked so hard and tried so diligently to expose these acts and prevent 9/11, even though they did not know it was going to occur.
And, of course, they knew it was going to occur because, actually, several FBI agents had gone anonymously to David Shippers, who had been the counsel for the House committee that impeached Bill Clinton. They'd gone to him and told him there was going to be an attack at the end of August or the first part of September in Lower Manhattan. And Shippers went to Washington, D.C., and, you know, although he knew John Ashcroft and wanted to tell him that the attack was coming, why John Ashcroft wouldn't see them, nor would any of the other congressional or Senate leaders that he had known and worked with before, so many of them, he wanted to talk to, and they wouldn't hear him. And then my friend Dr. Garth Nicholson, FBI agents he knew, came to him and told him the attack was going to be on the 11th of September, mentioned the Pentagon, did not mention the World Trade Center. He reported that to the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. But all sucks, nobody knew the attack was coming. Of course, somebody warned Willie Brown the night before. We know from the articles in the New York Newsweek magazine that officials at the Defense Department canceled their flights for the 11th of September. They canceled them on the 10th of September. And you know, the most amazing thing is the 9/11 Commission didn't investigate any of those things at all. All they did was put out all sorts of conflicting testimony to confuse the American people, but the major issues of what happened that day were never mentioned at all. Do you think it possibly, Garland, it had anything to do with the fact that the White House picked the head of the commission and laid out the rules for the commission and censored the report before it was given to the American people, before it could be published? If there's nothing to hide, why did they hide it? What are they afraid the American people would learn? What do you think would happen if the American people suspected that it was all a fraud, they knew the attack was coming and did nothing to stop it, just as, well, FDR knew the attack on Pearl Harbor was coming and did nothing to stop it? You know, it's the most incredible story. And where is the outrage from the American people? Why, they almost seem to be brain dead. They read the reports of the boys killed over in Iran, pardon me, in Iraq, and, well, they'll soon be reading the reports of the boys killed in Iran and in Syria as we move into World War III. Where is the moral outrage? We'll be back in just a moment with Garland Favorito. Well, Dr. Stan, I guess this evening, Garland Favorito. Go ahead, Garland.
Well, Dr. Stan, you've made quite an eloquent case for me, and I will just add a few points to your thought train there. I don't mind naming some names here. We've talked a lot about, generically, some of the people who are involved, but specifically, one of the individuals' names at FBI headquarters was Marion Spike Bowman. He was the FBI's National Security Law Unit, Deputy General Counsel, and basically Democrat and Republican senators had questioned him or had basically raised the question that why he had refused the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant in the Massawi investigation. And he ended up receiving the Presidential Meritorious Rank Award and a 20% pay increase after refusing that investigation. And Senator Grassley wanted to know why, and he got this long 3-page letter back from the FBI, and the bottom line of it was said was the men, you know, he'd worked a lot of hours and therefore deserved that raise and that promotion. So that was one example. He's not actually the only one who got promoted, though. Another individual, an FBI supervisory special agent back at headquarters named Michael Maltby, was implicated in removing some of the information from that FISA application, what they call the FISA application, and that information may have helped obtain the warrant on Massawi to begin with. Maltby was eventually promoted to the field supervisor position for the FBI in the Cleveland, Ohio office. They worked very closely together. Two examples there. And Maltby's boss, David Frasca, was the head of the FBI's Radical Fundamentalist Unit. He was implicated by the field office in thwarting not only the Massawi investigation, but ignoring the memo that came from Ken Williams in Phoenix about flight training from Hanji Hanjour and some of the other potential hijackers. So these three individuals in this just very tight little group effectively shut down several of the investigations all by themselves, which we found extremely, extremely strange.
And I agree with you, and I think that every American should ask, why weren't these people fired? Why wasn't anybody in the CIA or the FBI fired? In fact, we've heard so often, well, the real problem was the CIA couldn't talk to the FBI. The FBI couldn't talk to the CIA, and that really is an incredible lie. I've interviewed a Mr. I.C. Smith, who was a top government official. He was a top FBI agent, and he told me during our interviews, he said, you know, I could always talk to the CIA, and the CIA would talk to me. We talked all the time. So what is this about they couldn't talk to one another? And I would like to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that this is an intentional cover to justify what happened, to confuse the American people. You have to confuse them, because if indeed they knew it was going to happen and they did nothing to stop it, why, somebody is guilty of murder, murder at the highest levels of our government. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Garland has simply made the point that so many of the officials who were involved in allowing 9/1 to happen were actually promoted and given bonuses. And when one of the senators, Senator Grassley, had written the FBI and asked why, he got back a three-page letter saying, well, this one fellow, he worked so many hours, he worked so hard, and it worked overtime, and that's why we wanted to give him this large bonus. And ladies and gentlemen, they do not dare let the American people know the truth, or elected representatives know the truth. And, of course, they do not allow the information, the truth, to come out for the American people. And with the complicity of the mass media, the complicity of this little cabal that controls the media, and for those of you who have never read Ben Bedakian's wonderful book, The New Media Monopoly, which we carry, why Professor Bedakian has been studying the control of the media for over 20 years, actually 22 years now. He started in 1983 when 50 corporations dominated the media. Today, five major corporations dominate our media and determine what the American people hear, what they read, and what they see, and ultimately what they believe. And when you have this concentration of power in media, it is little wonder that nobody ever challenged of what the official party line is in Washington, D.C. So, Garland, what sort of response did you get to your articles that you published there, going into the background of the FBI complicity, obvious complicity, but it wasn't just the FBI. It was people at every level of government. A few people knew exactly what was going to happen and did nothing to stop.
That's right. And the response I got was pretty much the response that David Shippers got, and that was total silence. Not one word about from anyone in Washington D.C. about the article, and it just goes on. We actually have just only scraped the surface here. I mean, there are even other cases of another FBI agent, Haviz. He refused to secretly record an Arab terrorist suspect. This was in part of the Robert Wright case. He ended up getting promoted.
Now, here was an FBI agent who was a Muslim, and he refused to tape an interview with a Muslim who was suspected of being a terrorist because he said, I could never, tape another Muslim. His loyalty was to the Muslim faith, not to the FBI that was paying him, and he ends up getting promoted.
Right, to the American Embassy in Saudi Arabia. Another promotion. That same National Security Law Unit, I failed to mention earlier, also was cited for their refusal to provide information to a Cole case agent in the USS Cole bombing investigation, this agent wanted to open an investigation on one of the alleged hijackers, Al-Midar, in August of 2001, he was refused by the National Security Law Unit as well, that I mentioned earlier, Spike Bowman was part of. And it goes on and on and on. It's just quite amazing, the number of cases that have the FBI people who are either rewarded, and the string of people who have prevented investigations from happening. It's just fascinating.
Well, and the most amazing thing is that the FBI was tracking Mohammed Atta when he was over in Germany, and he was part of a small little cell over there, and he was being tracked when he was there. But then when he came to the United States, we're led to believe they didn't bother to track him. Then he went over to Spain in June or July of 2001, where he was tracked there. But when he comes back to the United States, we're told we'd had no idea he was a hijacker. Why? We had no idea that any of these people were hijackers. When one of the hijackers defected to the FBI in April of 2000 and said, I'm a hijacker, I'm part of a team of six or seven hijackers, we're trained in Pakistan, we're going to actually hijack your 747 and crash it to your building. What did the FBI do? Why, they immediately got him out of the country. They didn't try to find the rest of the people in the cell. And the only logical explanation there would be is they already knew who they were. They got this man. His name was Khan. They got him out of the country. If any of you doubt that, it's covered in Paul Thompson's Timeline. And, of course, you can hear Mr. Thompson talking about that in my interview with him in 911 update tape set. But yeah, I'm sure you're acquainted with all these things, aren't you, Garland?
Oh, yes, yes. It's amazing. And the string just goes on and on. We can keep on going deeper and deeper into the FBI's role in covering up for 9/11.
And, Chris, the agents in Newark, New Jersey, where the hijacker, Mr. Khan, came and said, I'm a hijacker, I'm part of a team, we're going to hijack your planes and crash them into buildings. The FBI agent and agents in Newark were all concerned, but the FBI agents in Washington, D.C. ordered them not only to send the man out of the country, but to have FBI agents accompany him to make sure he got to England. I wonder why. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Garland Favorito. Go ahead, Garland.
Well, there's some other areas where we could talk about in regards to the FBI and their role in 9/11. There was another agent, Thomas Freed, who's special agent in charge of counterterrorism FBI Washington field office. And his employees filed FBI 302 forms to document information received about the pending 9/11 attacks that they had gotten from an intelligence officer in Iran. He took no action on those. There was, of course, we talked a little bit about the coal bombing. You've mentioned how the FBI escorted so many people from Saudi Arabia out of the country so quickly, literally within a day or so. I find that kind of fascinating. How did they know that Saudi Arabia would be implicated in the attacks within the first day of 9/11? And how did they do all the appropriate checks on these people to get them out of the country so fast? I probably did not. I mean, it's just not really possible to have done either one of them. So essentially, they let all these people go, and it's kind of fascinating that they would allow these people to go out of the country when they actually could be suspects in the attacks. How do we know they didn't all end up down in those who participated in whatever manner and helped make this come about? How do we know they didn't end up in Lexington, Kentucky, and flying out of the country on those two Saudi Arabian planes that left? It's quite amazing. And another area we haven't even gone into yet that I know you've talked about before in your show is Sybil Edmonds and the translations after the fact of 9/11 and how several translators were told to stop translation of critical information that related to those terrorist activities immediately after 9/11. And that's a whole nother story about the FBI, again, trying to sabotage information and not allow it to come forward, and this is after the attacks. So both before and after the attacks, the FBI is not only preventing the investigations from going forward that could have prevented it, but then they're preventing documents from being translated that could identify who was involved.
All right, hold that thought for just a moment, and we'll be right back here with Garland. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience and you say, that can't be true, I refuse to believe it's true, why, you can certainly go to Paul Thompson's timeline and get the story of Mr. Khan. And, of course, he walked into the FBI office in April of the year 2000 and said, I'm a hijacker. This is covered in the initial investigation, the Joint Commission, the Joint Intelligence Committee investigation. We'd be glad to send you the page from that if you'd like to see it, where Eleanor Hill gave this testimony before the Joint Intelligence Committee. Of course, the media totally blacked out what she said. Her story about the hijacker did not mention they were going to cross the plane into the buildings because the FBI didn't tell her that. But of course, that's covered in Paul Thompson's timeline. But we'd be glad to send you a paper out of that investigation. And you would ask yourself, if this really took place, why didn't anybody ever hear of it? Why has that been blacked out? If you look at the August 6th memo that, of course, was given to the president, this was the president's daily intelligence briefing. And the title of it is Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. And, of course, the last sentence of that says this. The FBI is conducting approximately 70 full-fledged investigations or full-field investigations throughout the U.S. that it considers Bin Laden related. CIA and FBI are investigating a call to our embassy in the UAE in May saying that a group of Bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives. Now, this is what the report said. Now, then, of course, we're told the FBI and the CIA were absolutely certain, 99% certain the attack was going to be overseas. How can you basically justify what they said with what the PDD said? And we'd be glad to send any of you a free copy of the PDD, if we got this off of out of the 911 investigation. Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S., and the FBI is investigating the fact that they have information that a group of Bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives. And we are led to believe that the CIA and the FBI were absolutely certain the attack was going to be overseas. Do you really believe that? Well, if you do, then how do you explain the call to Willie Brown the night before? And we have verified that, not only by the newspaper reports, but by personally contacting the public relations director for Mayor Willie Brown in San Francisco. And, of course, we have the articles out of the Newsweek magazine, where not only on one occasion but two successive issues of Newsweek pointing out that high government officials in the Defense Department canceled their flights for the 11th of September. On the 10th of September, they knew the attack was coming. They knew the day the attack was coming. So why didn't we have any defense? Why did the people in the South Tower ordered to stay in their seats and continue working when they could look out the windows and see the flames shooting from the North Tower and the black smoke belching from the North Tower and people jumping out of the windows, and the people in the South Tower told, just stay in your seats, don't get up, don't move? And yet on the top floor, the head of security there at Morgan Stanley got 1,700 people out of that building in about 2 minutes because he knew it was under attack. But the Port Authority was ordering people to stay at their seats. That was never addressed by the 911 Commission and never addressed by our media. I wonder why. Go ahead, Garland. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Garland, he's done some great work on this. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go ahead, Garland.
And Dr. Stan, that question was asked by Kristen Breitwiser in her opening testimony before Congress. And, of course, Kristen was one of the she lost her husband at the WTC on 9/11, and she asked that very question as to why the New York Port Authority issued that that statement for everyone to stay in the building.
It was an order. They ordered them to stay at their seats, and her husband was one of the people who perished in the South Tower.
Exactly. I'm sorry. And so why would they issue that order to the individuals to have them keep in the building there and perish? And that question was never answered either in the congressional investigation or the 9/11 commission report, as you've already said, Dr. Stan. So it's just maybe we should talk a little bit about the fact that this is not just one isolated incident in 9/11. If we go back to other terrorist attacks against the United States, we also see FBI complicity. For example, in the WTC bombing in 1993, transcripts have shown that the FBI actually had an Egyptian informant named Imad Salam who helped make that bomb. But specifically interesting about these transcripts are, and audio transcripts, that they show how upset he was with the FBI New York field office director, who apparently was William Garvin at that time, and that for not stopping that plot. And he actually had two conversations with two different FBI agents about that, one named John Antisev and another Nancy Floyd, who basically agreed with him in these transcripts. They thought it was bad themselves, disgusting. So, and by the way, we mentioned all these individuals from the FBI. Now, any one of them, in fairness to them, any one of them, it could be, this could be just a coincidence, there could be a logical explanation, there could be a mistake, whatever. But when you put all of these together, that is when you see there is a pattern to really assist terrorists in committing terrorist acts against the United States. Another example, in the 1995 OKC bombing, Jana Davis, the K4TV investigative reporter, did a most probably the best investigation I've ever seen done, maybe not just for OKC bombing, but in general by a TV news station. She turned her evidence over to the FBI. The FBI refused to accept it. They had a tremendous amount of evidence, just amazing, and I've seen the videos of her investigative reports in Oklahoma City. They're just incredible. It went on for 2 years there for the station. But they would not investigate a man named Hussein al-Husseini, even though witnesses at these K4TV investigation series identified him as being with Timothy McVeigh before the bombing, at the scene of the crime when the bombing occurred, and driving a getaway vehicle to match the description broadcast over police radio.
Remember, of course, I don't know how many of the people in the audience remember, but I remember that morning very well because I was in an airport, waiting for a flight, and they were talking about these people from the Near East who were in running suits, and they were getting away, and this was in this pickup truck. They described they were from the Near East, they were in running suits, they were getting away in a pickup truck, and then they immediately, of course, changed the whole line, and it was the action of the lone bomber, Lee Harvey McVeigh, I think, no, it was Timothy McVeigh, who actually had written to his sister and said, I am part of a secret special forces unit involved in illegal activity, and that was, of course, brought out at the trial. Not one single word in the media about that. In fact, that's how Stephen Jones opened his defense, talking about the fact that Timothy McVeigh was working, or at least by his own admission, for the special forces involved in illegal activity. And if you'd like to verify that, it's in a book written by Stephen Jones and called The Oklahoma City, Others Unknown, The Oklahoma City Bombing Conspiracy. It was the second of the two books that he wrote, and we'll be glad to provide you the pages if you want to check that out yourself. Well, if Timothy McVeigh was really working for the government, involved with, of course, a special forces unit involved in illegal activity, that puts a whole different picture on this. If Terry Nichols was really going over to the Philippines and was in contact with a man named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and, of course, a man named Murad, who both were related very closely to this gentleman who was the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing. And, of course, they were all working with bin Laden. So why has that been suppressed? What was the relationship between Terry Nichols and the Islamic terrorists? Where was he getting his money to take repeated, not one trip, but repeated trips over there? We're not getting the truth, ladies and gentlemen. And, of course, we're not getting the truth about what happened in Oklahoma City. We're certainly not getting the truth about what happened to TW-800, and we're certainly not getting the truth about what happened on 9-1-1, and we certainly weren't told the truth why we went into Iraq. But you see, this was all planned, in my estimation, long beforehand, and I can prove that from many, many sources. If those of you who listen regularly know that to be the case. And, well, an awful lot of boys have died in Iraq, an awful lot have died in Afghanistan, but even more horrible than that, the figure is put at approximately 100,000 Iraqis, men, women, children, soldiers, civilians, have died over in Iraq. Is it 50,000? Is it 100,000? I don't know. But an awful lot of people are dying. And who's responsible? why the president says it was a mistake. We'll be right. Let's go to Tim, who's calling from Indianapolis. Go ahead, Tim.
Oh, hi, guys. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I had a question. I mean, the business of the Minnesota and the Phoenix incidences where these Middle Eastern people wanted to learn to fly, this is all smoke and mirrors. You wouldn't know that if they didn't want you to know that. And, I mean, these names, the Zakawi and Mohammed and Abdul, to me it's a red herring from the real terrorists. And, Galen, my question is, I mean, here we're high-level officials knew ahead of time, and today we're dropping B-52 bombs on Iraq, and Iraq is a terrorist. Galen, my question...
It's Garland. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Garland. You know, all these Arabic people names you bring up is really insignificant. Would you please comment on Building 7? Larry Silverstein ordered the New York Fire Department to pull it. Are they doing demolition now, or what, the New York Fire Department? Doesn't that tell you it was set up with explosives?
Yes, absolutely. That's an excellent point that we didn't even mention. Of course, Building 7 was the demolition went off at approximately 5 o'clock, give or take an hour, somewhere between 4:30 and 5:30. That building collapsed, and exactly as you mentioned, Silverstein has admitted that it was taken down on purpose. And of course, Silverstein was the owner of the WTC complex. It's not clear whether he himself gave the order or whether it came from someone else, but he has confirmed that that building was destroyed on purpose because it's been a big mystery. How did it just suddenly collapse? No one has admitted anything about that. But you're right, that was a point that very few people know about. But he did actually publicly admit that the building was destroyed intentionally.
And, of course, the interesting thing about this is there is no instance in all history where any steel-reinforced building has ever collapsed because of a fire. No instance in all history, but it happened to all, not simply Building 1 and Building 2, but Building 3, Building 4, Building 5, Building 6, and Building 7 in the World Trade Center complex. Isn't that interesting that it's never happened before, but it happened to those buildings? And then, of course, what's even more incredible is that Building 7 wasn't hit by any flying debris. We don't know how the fire started, but, you know, so let the fire burn out. Why did they take the building down? If you've ever seen the pictures of it, of course, you see that it begins to collapse from the bottom, not from the top where the fire was, but from the very bottom, as if somebody had planted explosives. Now, do you honestly believe that when there was a fire in the building, somebody's rushing in with explosives and planting them there to bring the building down at 5 o'clock on the evening of the 11th of September? Or were those explosives there beforehand? That is the big question. We can argue about what happened to the Building 1 and Building 2, and there are certainly many, many good people who say that just happened just the way that we're told, but there are other people who say no. There was evidence that the major girders, there were 46 major steel structures that held up the building, and down in the basement where they were anchored, of course, there's nothing but molten metal. How would you get molten metal down there, molten metal? Why was it so hot, you know, for literally weeks afterwards? Some areas were too hot even to go into when they were removing the debris. There had to be something else going on in the American people, I do not believe, have ever really been told the truth about what happened that day. And the great tragedy is that this was used to bring us into this war, and this war is not going to end, and our troops are not going to come home, and more and more American boys are going to die. When are the American people going to be willing to take a stand, to check the facts, to look and see what the evidence is? You only have to look at one or two things. I mean, there's so much evidence out there, but simply the magic passports, that alone should make you realize this whole thing was planned ahead of time. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Garland, how can people get your writings? How can they get your articles?
Well, the they're published in so many areas, I can't even keep track of them. Media Bypass publishes most of my work. We send out some of the articles with the book, and through blackforestpress.com, and that number there is 888-808-5440.
Now, give that one more time.
Sure. That's 888-808-5440. And in addition to the book, we send out some electronic news articles on things that have happened recently, like a lot of what we discussed tonight is actually in the book, almost all of it.
Now, did you write the book? Who wrote the book?
Yes, I'm sorry. I wrote the book. Actually, it's the second edition.
And what's the title of the book?
It's called Our Nation Betrayed.
Nation Betrayed, right.
And it covers the area of the Clinton impeachment through election 2000 and on through 9/11, and have supported that also with the incredible story about the invasion of Iraq and how, as you said, it was planned ahead of time, and there was many, many false pretenses that facilitated that invasion. They were all known ahead of time to be false. No mistake there. We invaded intentionally.
And, of course, if it was all a mistake, then who's responsible for the American boys have died? Who's responsible for the Iraqis who've died? 70, tens of thousands of Christians have fled from Iraq, fled for their lives, because at least under Saddam they could practice a religion and live in peace. Under the new Muslim government that we're going to install there, why the Christians were really afraid for their lives. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, our guest is Garland Favorito, and a lot of people just assume we forgot about 911. Let's get on with the problems we have. They're really important problems, like, is it true that most baseball players are taking steroids and growth hormone? Or is it really, how are we going to solve the problems of Social Security so that the elderly will be cared for by the government in years to come? Or what's going to happen to the economy? You see, we have to face the fact that we are involved in a war halfway around the world, and that war is going to continue and it's going to expand, and we are already at war for all intents and purposes with Iran, since we have unmanned aircraft flying over through the sovereign airspace of Iran, and they're not shooting them down, which they have a perfect right to do, because they don't want to give us an incident to justify an attack. According to Seymour Hersh in the recent article in New Yorker magazine, why we have special forces units that are operating in the sovereign land of Iraq. How would you feel if the Chinese communists had their special forces operating in the Sierra Maestra of California? Wouldn't we be upset at that? There are Israeli special forces. I have from other sources. I believe this is true, and I think this is going to lead into World War III. What are your thoughts, Garland?
Well, exactly right. You have mentioned that, of course, Iran is the next target, and I think that's pretty clear. The Israelis are behind that. They were also part of what was behind the Iraq invasion, just one small part. There were so many motivating factors there. The support for the Israelis. I go into all those in quite detail in the one of my articles. It's just amazing. But as you mentioned, there are certain areas, Iran probably being the top one, and of course another area that's up there is Colombia, where all the cocaine grows, and we know that the CIA would love to gain total control of that. Just as they did in Afghanistan with the world's largest opium production, and it's just there's always an excuse. Where an invasion is, it's usually drugs or oil. Or somebody once said, I think it was maybe it was Michael Rupert, who said that the god of these people is not our god. It's global oil and drugs.
Well, if you said I We'll perhaps talk about that some other time. Colin, we're out of time. God bless you. The hour just flew by, but thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you. I really appreciate what you're doing.
God bless, and give me a call anytime you got something new.
Okay, well
done. Good night. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess, of course, we've gone in Favorito. His telephone number is 888-808-5540. If you'd like to get his book, A Nation Betrayed, that's 888-808-5540. And, of course, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to helping us. As 5 hours every day, we reach out somewhere across America on radio. 5 hours a day, you can pick us up on the Internet. 5 hours a day, you can pick us up on satellite. And 4 hours a day, you can pick us up on shortwave. And the evening program is heard on two different frequencies. So we'd certainly appreciate, very seriously, if you'd give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Another thing you can do, of course, you've heard me mention this before, but we are reprinting My Brotherhood of Darkness, which I think is the best book to give you an understanding of who the true God of the people who are running things is. Because this is all spiritual, and you must understand that there are people who have a different view of the world. They have a different vision of what the world should be. They worship a different God. Well, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will give you an excellent overview of the forces working behind the scenes. We've a need, of course, to get some help to get that reprinted. So we're making an offer of the people will buy or get a case of our books. Why, of course, it's an amazing deal. You'll never be able to parallel it. And, of course, once those cases are gone, we won't be able to make that offer again until we come to another reprinting. And, of course, when that will be, I have no idea. But we hope that many of you will give serious consideration. We've already just got almost halfway through to our goal of getting those people getting to take the cases. Cases are actually 62 books, and if you'd like to learn more about that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I would mention it's a wonderful, wonderful deal. You're not going to find anything like it. And, of course, this book will allow you to reach other people. Then go in with somebody else and get a case of them. 62 books, Brotherhood of Darkness. And, of course, give them as gifts. Get people to read them. You can transform their lives and perhaps save their souls for eternity. So remember, the book is Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get it, individual copies, video, but you can also get a case of them, and just give us a call if you'd like more detail at 1-800-544-8927. If you have not yet seen the videos, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, Megiddo 1 is an excellent tool to teach biblical prophecy. Megiddo 2 gives you the whole story from creation right up to what's going on today. Madame Blavatsky, actually, I'm on the video talking about Madame Blavatsky, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, about the Georgia Guidestones, and you'll see the Georgia Guidestones. You won't have to go back to Elberton on your own. And there you'll see the plan for the world. Maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. Written in eight different languages on those four great guidestones. There was a 10-point plan to replace the Ten Commandments. And, of course, it was the major planning for our society until they wrote the Earth Charter. Gorbachev and Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller wrote that, the Earth Charter, which sort of replaces in many respects the message there on the Georgia Guidestones. But you must understand, they do intend to kill off most of the world's population. And if you doubt that, why, of course, we have that article out of UNESCO Courier in November of 1991, where they quote Jacques Cousteau as saying, it's a terrible thing to say, but we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. We're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day. If you'd like to get that, of course, the pages from the article, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, consider getting They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, and Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. until, well, we'll be back in the next hour to continue. We've got a fascinating guest. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And well, let me tell you that that phrase, I open my programs every day with that little slogan, reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. Who said that? Why, the person who said it was an American hero, in my estimation. His name was Congressman Larry McDonald. He was certainly a charismatic leader. He was certainly well-known in Congress. He was respected. He ran as a conservative Democrat from Georgia. And certainly he had the potential to lead the conservative movement and really make a difference. We know from our friends that they had in the Communist Intelligence Division a desk where they would monitor American politicians. And they would usually have one Soviet intelligence officer monitoring the activities of two or three or four American leaders or politicians. But, of course, they had two intelligence officers monitoring Larry McDonald all the time because they felt he was a threat. But he was a threat not only to the Russians. He was a threat to the people in the United States who've worked with the Russians and helped the Russians and the communists since the very inception, because Larry McDonald was talking, and he had his foundation, that spent a great deal of money getting out information on how the United States had helped Russia starting in 1917, and we were still helping them today. And I remember getting the material, the articles out of the paper. All you have to do is read the paper, and you're constantly finding one excuse after another to give aid or technology or information to communist China or to the Soviet Union or to Russia, to communist Russia, or to the communist Muslim states. We're financing most of them in the Middle East today, and they're all controlled by communists, or we call them ex-communists. I guess that's the nice way, but let's get back to Larry McDonald. Well, this evening I've asked D.V. Kidd to be with us because D.V. has written a fascinating article about what happened to Korean Flight 007. And I'm going to ask D.V. to pick up the story from there. Go ahead, D.V.
Well, it all started the evening of September 1st, 1983, when KAL-007 left Anchorage, Alaska. And I might add that Senator Jesse Helms was on the original leg of the flight, and he got off that flight. And in fact, which is to me very heartbreaking, he had a conversation with a little girl who's about 5 years old. Her and her mother got on the flight, and of course, they are, hopefully, they're still alive. But the plane took off, and the official line was that the Russians shot the plane out of the sky.
No, of course, it was flying then from Alaska, from Anchorage, Alaska. It was flying to into Korea, supposedly.
Yeah, and supposedly it strayed into Soviet airspace. But the time zone differences make all of the, you know, I had my daughter, because when I did the story, I was already here in California, but I had Brandy go to the big library in Denver and download everything she could get from the newspapers on their microfilm, and then I did the same thing when I finally got here to the big library. And the newspapers, the accounting of what went on was at the time that the plane went down, the families were told that the plane had been shot down, but it landed safely. And in fact, the president of Korean Airlines, and of course this would be the next day, it would still be September 1st here when Reagan announced this terrible tragedy and the Russians took out the plane. But on the other side of the world, the families were told that the plane managed to land and that all of the passengers were safe and alive on this island called Sakhalin. And so the president of Korean Airlines, after speaking with Russian officials and was assured that the passengers were alive, he got on a plane to go negotiate their release, because at the time they didn't have any formal diplomatic relations between the countries. Within 24 hours, then Secretary of State George Shultz, along with Ronald Reagan, made all kinds of noise about how, you know, terrible, and, you know, they were doing search of the plane debris. But it didn't match up to several people who eventually did incredible research. And one of those, it was a man named David Brunn, a Frenchman, who spent 10 years researching this. And he actually went to the island and found some debris from the plane. But according to the people on the island, there were no dead bodies. The people, the passengers were alive. 63 Americans were on that flight. And I absolutely believe, from all of the research that I've done, and including talking to some of the family members who've had even better access to material than I have, that the passengers did indeed survive, and that the Russians have been holding them as political pawns all these years. I didn't find out until much later, after I did the first column, what really happened that night, that Ronald Reagan almost took us to World War III, because there was actually a shootout between Russian MiGs and American Air Force jets, and we lost 33 servicemen, and the government has lied to their families to this day about what really happened to them. The whole thing is one of the most putrid cover-ups that you can imagine.
And of course, what is so incredible is the fact that the American people were led to believe that, that the plane went down, but there just weren't any bodies at all. There wasn't any wreckage. Apparently, there was some sort of a hole in the plane that a little of the luggage got up, but very little of it. And what happened then to all the bodies? What happened to the wreckage of the plane? Because when a plane goes down at sea, there's wreckage. But there wasn't any wreckage here. So, and of course, the reports, I can remember the initial reports saying the plane had landed safely, and then suddenly, we were told an entirely different story. Oh, shucks, we were wrong. The plane didn't land safely. It crashed, and everybody died. And so we immediately set out search units, but the Russians wouldn't let us get close to the area where the plane went down.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
And then, of course, it was all nothing but a smokescreen, because you're right. The search area was nowhere near where the plane allegedly was shot down over the sky by the Russians. And I've given a lot of information in the two articles I did, Incidents Colin and then the follow-up, where the families, and that old drunk Boris Yeltsin, I'm sure that Vladimir Putin to this day regrets what Yeltsin did. Because,
hold that thought right there.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening is D.V. Kidd, who just does some wonderful, wonderful articles. And you'll want to get on her email list. You'll want to read her articles. D.V. does great research. And she's written a book that has a million and a half copies out there about the Federal Reserve scam. But right now we're talking about Flight 007. And of course, initially, after The reports came in that it had been attacked by a Soviet plane. We were told that the plane was damaged. They were able to control it and land it safely on Sakhalin Island. And then suddenly the official story changed. Oh no, the plane didn't land safely. The people were not all safe, as everybody in the Far East had been told. Why, the plane had crashed at sea and everybody was lost. Everybody on board was lost. But there was no luggage. There were no bodies. Why, they just couldn't find the plane. Aw, shucks. But somehow or other, they got the black boxes. And then, of course, when they got the black boxes, why, they'd removed the tapes from them. What did they have to cover up? If there's nothing to cover up, why did they remove the black boxes from the tapes? So pick up the story there, please, Devi.
Right. And like I said, when the stage downfall of the Soviet Union occurred several years later, Boris Yeltsin did release massive amounts of formerly classified information, and so the families were able to get their hands on all these documents and read the transcripts, the official transcripts of the Russian pilots who actually did fire at KL-007 and did hit it, but, you know, they didn't blow it out of the sky. The easiest, I guess the best way to bring this into, you know, real time is that here in the United States, obviously Reagan knew what happened, you know, and I understand, you know, he's passed away, you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead and all that, but this man was not the perfect president that conservatives have made him out to be. He had an awful lot to answer for, but in real time, you can imagine the scrambling that was going on at the White House. But on the other side of the world, completely different events were taking place. As I said a few minutes ago, the president of Korean Airlines was on the phone. He was told the passengers were there. And so he was making the arrangements to fly there to try to, you know, get some sort of diplomatic negotiations for release of these people. Do you really think that the president of Korean Airlines would just put out, you know, the word to the media over there that, oh gosh, I'm just, you know, this is just, you know, a waste of my time or whatever? I mean, all of the rescue efforts and retrieval of the passengers was underway. And in fact, Congressman McDonald's aides, his office was notified that the passengers were alive. And it wasn't until the next day they were in shock when they found out that, oh no, the plane was blown to bits. But when you read Michael Brun's book, and then there was another book, and boy, I'm having a brain cramp. I can't remember the title of it. It was the second book that came out that had just tremendous amount of documents in it. This guy really worked his tail off on doing the research. And then the other book called War Scare, the guy is actually a spook. His last name is Fry, where he comes out and he says right there in the book, and I believe it's chapter 3, he said when this incident happened, he called his wife. You know, this is a spook. CIA. He called his wife and told her to take their daughter and get out of Washington, D.C. immediately, because he was certain that Reagan was going to take us to World War III, because, in fact, what happened that night was that the United States military, the Air Force, got into a shootout with these Russian MiGs, and the debris field that the eventual rescue and retrieval operation, that was for the Russians to pick up what was left of their MiGs and for the United States to hide what we lost, 33 military that night.
And of course, they have to cover this up from the American people, as with so many things, because of course, I believe that our government knows that Larry McDonald is still a prisoner, that all those Americans are still prisoners.
Yep.
And we abandoned 25,000 Americans after the Second World War, and we left them to rot in communist prisons. And this is well known by anybody who's ever studied it. We have the Helms Committee report that goes into the background of that. But not a word from the controlled media. Well, let's go to Tony, who's calling from Soquel. And then, of course, we know that there were several thousand prisoners, 8,000 prisoners were abandoned after Korea. Many of them were tortured to death. They've suppressed that information from the American people. Several thousand abandoned after Vietnam, and they've suppressed that information. In fact, Senator Kerry was one of the biggest people suppressing that information. He and Senator John McCain, that great patriot. Right now, we've got Tony calling from Soquel. Tony, do you have a question or comment?
I wanted to bring up Larry McDonald, and you already did.
All right, fine. Well, go ahead.
but I would say that illusion is usually scoffed at. I mean, a reality is usually scoffed at, and illusion is usually king. And I believe Larry McDonald was the one who said that.
He did?
And I believe he was running against a congressman in, at the time, who was replaced by Richard Nixon.
No.
Vorace? Jerry Vorace?
No. That was a long, long, long time before that. No, he was a congressman from Georgia. Nixon was from California. Now, it must be a different McDonald.
Larry McDonald?
Larry McDonald was a congressman from Georgia, and of course Nixon was a congressman from California, so his battle with Jerry Voorhees was an entirely different battle, and of course an even different time frame.
Well, I'm certainly glad you straightened me out on that, Dr.
Okay.
Chan.
Dv, correct me if I'm wrong, am I?
No, that is correct, and... You know, one of the occurrences, or I don't know how else to phrase it, but there were a lot of Russian people of the Jewish faith who were leaving Russia in the early 90s. And when they got to Israel, they started talking to some of these, you know, international organizations about what they saw in some of these gulags. And they told all of these stories about Americans being held in these gulags, and word gets around villages and stuff like that. It's very hard to keep these types of things secret. But in fact, one family that emigrated from Russia into Israel said that this American woman, who was a passenger on some airplane, they didn't know what, eventually married one of her guards just to get out of prison. But there were too many first-hand eyewitness accounts of these prisoners being seen. And you know, the Schlossbergs, I can't remember his first name. I have talked to him on the telephone. His father-in-law is Korean, and he was on the flight. And bless their hearts, they worked so hard all these years. And like I said in my last column about, you know, when is Bush going to demand that Putin release these passengers? Can you imagine what it's been like for these families for over 20 years with the American people more interested in Desperate Housewives or some stupid reality show, while they have spent all this time trying to get their loved ones back? That little girl that Jesse Helms talked to after he got off the flight and she got on it, she was only 5 or 6 years old. What did they ever do, regardless of what country they were from, all these passengers, to deserve such a fate as this? Well, nobody seems to care.
Well, I think the thing was that they wanted to get rid of Larry McDonald. And it wasn't just the communists who wanted to get rid of him. It was the people in our government, because he was pointing out that our government was financing the communists and creating the best enemy money could buy. And we could never let the American people know that. We can never let them know the truth. We actually have, of course, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee reports on this whole issue. We have the book, Rescue 007. We even have a four-tape set where you'll actually hear my interviews with Bert Schlossberg and several other people dealing with what happened that evening and, of course, the subsequent investigation. And they've actually talked to many of the people from that area. The local people know what happened to the plane and how it eventually was towed out to sea and sunk. But the drivers went down and there weren't any bodies in it. And they said, oh, the crabs ate them. That's what happened. The crabs ate them all. That's why there are no skeletons. There's nothing else there. The crabs ate them
all. One of these days, one of those passengers is going to show up. One of these days, you watch.
No, I would hope you'd be right, TV, but our government could never allow the American people to know the truth. Certainly when the one man came home, Bobby Garwood, from Vietnam, they had to destroy him. They would have killed him, but they couldn't very well do that, and so they had to try him as a traitor and make out that he was a terrible man and he had defected to the other side, and you couldn't believe anything that he said because he was talking about all the other men he saw there that we abandoned.
The American people abandoned him. Yeah.
Tony, did you have anything else you wanted to ask?
Don't forget they called Bobby Garwood a child molester, too.
Right.
My question is, what do Larry McDonald, Congressman George Hansen, and James Traficant have in common? And I'll take the answer on the air.
All right, fine. For our listeners who don't know why, George Hansen was charged of phony charges, sent to prison, supposedly because he had violated the fair election laws. He'd filled out a form wrong. And they tortured him for 10 long years until suddenly the Supreme Court said, hey, George, we never should have sent you to court. We didn't have any authorization to do that. Sorry. And by this time, his reputation was gone. That bankrupted him. His health was gone. But they let him out of prison. Wasn't that nice?
Yeah, and his teeth were rotten. And, you know,
and he had the scar. Of course, his big problem was he went back and he showed all the congressmen the scars on his leg from when they tortured him. And that scared the congressmen so much, most of them don't have the testosterone level high enough to take a stand against what's going on.
And because the American people haven't taken to the streets and demanded that this type of thing stop, they keep reelecting the same scum over and over and over.
And of course, Congressman Traficant was another congressman who spoke out against the corruption at the highest levels of our government. They spent 6 months to get him. They had people planted in his office and watching him, and of course, giving perjured testimony. And the Supreme Court won't even hear the case. And there were so many irregularities in the case of Congressman James Traficant. He's been demonized by the media. Everything's been done to discredit him, but what would you expect of the man who was telling the truth? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, D.V. Kidd, we're talking about the downing of Flight 007. And so, D.V., the point you're trying to make is the American people have to understand that they've been lied to about 007. If they could be lied to about 007, how can we believe what they say about anything else? If the media will cover up for that, if people in intelligence will cover up for it, if people in the executive branch and the President of the United States will cover it up, and will leave those people to rot in Soviet prisons. You know, I understand that they've actually traced Larry McDonald's location, that there were actually a group over in Israel that was tracking where various prisoners were, and there was a great deal to suggest that they actually tracked Larry McDonald's position for some years. Did you hear those stories?
I've heard a number of stories, and I know of an organization down in Phoenix who pretty much pinpointed where he was, but getting him out is a completely different, you know, ball game altogether. And, you know, back in February of 1993, when I was running for Congress, I got a phone call out of the clear blue from some man. And he asked me if I knew about KL007. I said I really didn't. I remembered when it happened. And long story short, I met him in a coffee shop, and he had a file that was marked top secret. And he allowed me to read the file, and it had all kinds of communications between a Navy vessel that was in the area at that time, and it pretty much confirmed, you know, the dogfight that went on. And I was in shock. This man wouldn't let me, copy any of the documents, but I promised him that if I got elected to Congress, I would blow that whole thing wide open in a heartbeat. And after my meeting with him, I called Jesse Helms' office, because a lot of the documents, it took me about an hour to sit through and read the file, and he sat there. I couldn't leave the room. And I worked for the Department of Defense. I had a secret clearance. I know what classified documents look like. And these were originals. They were not copies of anything. But I immediately called Jesse Helms' office and got a hold of some staffer, and it took about 45 minutes back and forth. Can I put you on hold and blah, blah, blah. And finally, you know, the end result of the phone call was that the three original longtime staffers for Helms who did the investigations and stuff were all let go for some reason, and the aide that I talked to did not know why. And I knew deep in my heart exactly why these people were let go, and they were probably let go with the admonition that they had better keep their mouths shut. And from, you know, I was sick. I couldn't sleep for a couple of days. The whole thing made me just want to gag. And I just tell people at this point in time, if you get on an international flight, it's Russian roulette. Because you're either going to be a TWA Flight 800 or you're going to be a KAL-007. And this government will flush you down the toilet in a heartbeat for political expediency. So you want to take an international flight? Take your chances.
Well, I think the great tragedy is, of course, that this has been so effectively covered up by the controlled media. We actually have copies of top secret files that actually came out of Jesse Helms' investigation and put together by those people that you're talking about who work for Jesse Helms. We actually make those available through Radio Liberty and, of course, so much other information, the four tape set, and, of course, the book, Rescue 007. There is no question in my mind that, of course, Larry McDonald did survive. And, of course, he is being kept someplace in prison, and our government knows it, and they want to be sure he stays there.
It is absolutely...
Hold that thought.
Oh.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is D.B. Kidd. We're talking about Korean Flight 007, or KLF Flight 007, and of course there are some secret government files, top secret files. We have copies of these files, and we'll make them they're available through Radio Liberty, as is book Rescue 007 by Bert Schlossberg, as is the four tape set we put together. Now, these are of historical interest. Most people, they don't even remember 07, or they don't like to think about it. But, you see, we have to remember the past. For those who cannot remember the past are condemned to relive it and or repeat it. This is so true. And you have to understand that the Reagan administration knew that Larry McDonald survived. But, of course, he was hated because he was exposing the fact that under successive administrations, whether they be Democrat or Republican, why, we were always finding one or another excuse to give massive aid or massive loans or massive technology to the communists, whether it be the communist Chinese, and we're doing everything we can to build them up today, or whether it be the communists in Russia, or we're doing everything we can, of course, to build them up, or the communists in Cuba. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the communists in Cuba. In fact, when Fidel Castro came to New York City, why, he spoke before the Council on Foreign Relations, and then, if you read the very, very fine print in David Rockefeller's book, memoirs of David Rockefeller, you'll find out that Fidel Castro had a private meeting with David Rockefeller. Now, why would the evil head of the Cuban communist government who hates capitalists have a private meeting with David Rockefeller? And if he is really such a threat to America, why didn't the CIA, of course, take him out at that time? Of course, we've been trying for years. We know that they've been trying to take out Fidel Castro because he hates America. Or is reality usually scoffed at and illusion usually king? So what are your thoughts on that, D.B.? Do you think it's possible that one of the reasons they had to get rid of Larry McDonald was because people all across America were beginning to understand that the so-called conflict between communism and capitalism was as phony as the conflicts between Abbott and Costello or Laurel and Hardy?
Well, my good friend General Ben Parton wrote about this back in the late 50s about the Soviet-Sino conflict was nothing but a hoax. It was a smokescreen that the communists, the propagators of world communism, were throwing up for people to, you know, to look at the boogeyman. But in fact, the United States, communist Chinese and the communist Russians, they are the communitarian altruistic allies. They are determined to take over the world. That, you know, anybody who denies this hasn't done their homework. But, you know, incidents like KL-007, you know, they have a real effect. There are, you know, hundreds of family members to this day who are affected by what happened and the agony that they must go through every day, knowing that their loved ones are in some garbage dump of a gulag. And you see President Bush on TV in his expensive suit and his cabinet members and Condoleezza Rice stand there, and they all look like they're so important, and, you know, they're, you know, dignitaries and all that. These people make me want to gag when I, you know, stop and think about the secrets that they're hiding. KL-007 is, you know, was probably one of the first after all of the wars, you know, of all of our servicemen being held, you know, through TWA Flight 800. And I just, it, it makes me angry at sometimes, but in my own mind, I know that eventually all of this is going to, you know, explode onto the American scene one of these days. All of this truth is going to come out, just like Pearl Harbor is going to come out. It took a long time. But the American people are distracted. They're addicted to television. They're addicted to drugs and pornography, and they, you know, everybody's out there trying to chase two nickels around to put food on the table, and unless they can see a real and tangible threat in front of their face, things like KL007 don't seem to matter. But I've tried to keep it alive by writing about it periodically, hoping that somewhere along the line, people will, you know, take some sort of step. The problem, as you pointed out, Stan, earlier, is the Congress themselves. The United States Congress is made up of cowards. There is no other adjective to describe these people. They are simply cowards. And the ones that aren't cowards are the crooks.
Well, our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our desk, our guest is D.V. Kidd. D.V., where can people read your material?
They can read it on my website. It's just dv.com. And I have a great new section we'll have to talk about after the music.
All right, fine. It's dv.com. You want to read TV's material. Of course, I get more emails from her than I do from just about anybody else, but all with fascinating material. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty, and welcome your calls, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, D.V. Kidd, and of course we're talking about Flight 007, Korean Flight 007, that went down in 1983. And of course, the government did everything they could to cover up for this. They could not admit, of course, what had happened. Did we ask for the Russians to pay for the plane that they shot down, the civilian airliner? Did we ask them to pay any sort of compensation to the families, the victims who died? In fact, when Kathy McDonald tried to sue the Koreans for $50 million, the IRS charged her income tax on the money that she would have received if she, if she'd gotten a settlement. She didn't get a settlement from them, but they charged her income tax on the money anyway. How would you do something like that? Well, of course, this was to punish her for daring to try to sue the Koreans for killing her husband, or maybe they didn't kill her husband. That's even a worse thing to think of. So, you know, pick up the story there, TV. Let's wait a moment or two to tell our listeners about the other things, because we want to make sure that all of our listeners have returned. Some of the people, of course, are not listening right now. It's being broadcast locally on the Internet. But I want all of our shortwave listeners and the listeners on stations out across America to hear more about the work you're doing and about your website. But anything else you'd like to bring up about Korean Flight 007 before we go on?
Well, people should really read the articles that I've written on it, because they are truly in-depth articles. And like I said, at this, you know, if you take an international flight, you're literally putting your destiny in your hands, because if something goes wrong, this government will just cash you out. You'll never see the light of day again. And those children that were on that flight, these are children 5 and 6 years old. What has happened to their lives for over two decades? Someday, you know, these people, everybody has to meet their makers, and so, you know, justice sometimes is slow.
Well, at first we hear about the Diary of Anne Frank, and we hear about the horrors of the Holocaust. We never hear about, of course, the horrors of the Soviet Gulag, the prisoners that died there. 60 million people died in the Gulag. But why is it that we always talk about the Holocaust, the German Holocaust, and never about the 60 million people that were killed by the communists, or the 80 to 100 million people that were killed by the Chinese communists? In fact, between 1958 and 1962, they starved to death 40 million people, a book called The Hungry Ghost.
And how about the 3 million Catholics who died during the Holocaust?
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is D.B. Kidd. We were just talking about how it is that we always talk about the 6 million Jews who died, and this is a terrible, terrible thing. But D.B. is pointing out there was about 3 million Catholics. According to Professor Norman Cohn in his book, Warrant for Genocide, he says there were 12 million others, and I believe the vast majority of those were Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, and there were some gypsies, and there were some disabled prisoners. But why don't we ever talk about the 12 million others who died, in the other Holocaust, in the prison camps of Hitler's Germany? Why do we never talk about the 60 million that died in Russia, or the 80 to 100 million who died in communist China? I was just pointing out that there were 30 to 40 million who starved to death intentionally in China between 1958 and 1962, and that has been totally suppressed here in America. I know my friend Stephen Mosier lived in China for a time, talked to many of the people who survived what was known as the Great Hunger. And, of course, his books by that is a book called Hungry Ghosts, which we actually have in our library. All of this information is suppressed. They may put out one edition of the book, a few thousand copies, and then, of course, why they never published again. Because the last thing they want is for the American people to know that our government is complicit. And when I speak of our government, I'm speaking of the evil people, not the good people who represent America, but the evil people who represent what I believe is the Brotherhood of Darkness, that works at the highest echelons of our government, of our intelligence agencies, of our media, of our foundations, of our corporations. And they have an agenda. Their goal is the destruction of America, the establishment of a world government, and a new world religion. Well, D.B., I want you to tell our listeners about your website and about how they can get hold of your articles. And our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295.
Well, my website is just dv.com, but I have a new feature on my website. It's called The Reading Room, and it has two sections. I haven't gotten to section two, which is books and videos, but section number one, I am scanning my entire office. I finally figured out how to do this after all these years. For the past 14 years, since I got into the movement, and it was because of the Federal Reserve, not taxation, but I have file cabinets full of documents. I have reports. I have treaties. I have all this information. A lot of it is not available on the website, but I get about 15,000 emails a month, and it's, you know, individual requests. Where did you find this? And there's no way I can answer that all that email. So I finally decided, and I learned how to scan all these documents and get them posted. And so slowly but surely, all of these years, everything that I've collected is being put into the reading room. We currently have two of the files up. One is about 479 pages. The second one is 79 pages, and it is one of the more interesting ones, because while I was at the State Archives, the big library, doing some research for Larry Becraft, who's an attorney, I stumbled on all of these resolutions by the different state legislatures and this was only about a year after the 16th Amendment was allegedly ratified, but all of these state legislatures wanted the income tax gotten rid of. They didn't want it. And I thought, when I first saw these, I went through one legislature after another, and I said, oh my gosh, if all these states didn't want the 16th Amendment, how come it ended up getting passed? But all of these documents have been scanned. I just sent one of my webmasters another 11 sets of files. It's probably another 500 pages, but we're going to do it, you know, in smaller bites. Of everything that I've got, I'm turning my office into a virtual library so that Americans can see all of these documents. They can do all this research. It's available to them. They can do whatever they want. They can print them out or read them, you know, download them and read them. But, I want to give everybody as much, you know, research materials as they can handle.
Well, I think that's really so important. You have to have the information available. And I wish we had the time to do exactly the same thing here. But I congratulate you for making that available. And, of course, that's dv.com. That's dv.com. Go there and read D.B. Kidd's articles on 007 and, of course, so many other issues that D.B.'s right on. You must write about, what, 5 articles a week? It seems like you're writing a new one every day.
Well, I write the I write a weekly column for WorldNet Daily. I write a weekly column for News with Views. I have my own website, of course, but and that contains all of, you know, my past writings. And on my CD is another, we just added another 250 items to that, which are different from the stuff that I'm scanning. But as an example, the hearings, and I don't think I can reach the book from here, but we often hear the quote from Rowan, from Mr. Norman Dodds, Dodds about Rowan Gaither. That came from some hearings in Illinois in 1978. Those hearings, I have them. They're 700 pages. I haven't scanned that yet, but I'll tell you what. These hearings on regional governance, and I will get it scanned in seven different sections, 100 pages at a time, are absolutely a mind blower. If people can see and those hearings, and also I've already scanned some of the stuff from the newspapers back in the 30s and 40s, where they were actually exposing the plan for world government. The new super secret constitution is now established. I have the newspapers from back when FDR declared the bank holiday. Believe it or not, the newspapers then, the headlines were dictatorial powers from FDR. They were paying attention back then, but unfortunately it didn't seem to make, you know, an impression on the American people because of the deliberately created depression. So all of this stuff, like I said, I'm scanning as fast as I can, and we'll get it up on my website so that people can see that this isn't just some conspiracy theory, that these plans for world domination under communism is a very real thing, and they better get with it.
Well, of course, what people don't understand is we have supported communism. Why? Because communism is basically an elitist system by which a small group controls the masses. That's exactly what we're imposing here in America and why we've always supported communism. In fact, it was Gus Hall, the head of the Communist Party, writing back in 1960s saying, we have more socialism in America than they have in Russia today. And that's it. It was Norman Thomas, the head of the Socialist Party, who said, the American people never really accept communism, but they'll expect one or another's system of welfare until one day they wake up and find they're living in a communist America.
Yes, and that's very true. And this is the second radio show I've done today. The first one was from the Midwest I did early this afternoon. And, you know, one of the callers was a first-time caller that called into the show. And he had a lot of questions. And I said, look, you know, said, well, why don't people pay attention? And I said, it's very simple. These diabolical engineers of this world government have been very, very effective. You know, critical path planning is the key to everything. And these people plan ahead by decades. They don't just plan ahead for tomorrow. But what they've done with the income tax and their central bank is put the American people in a position where they are so wearied by getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, getting the kids up, getting them, you know, breakfast, and both parents are working, they're out the door, the kids go get tossed off to some strangers in daycare or the government indoctrination centers they call public school system. They come home at night, they stop and buy some garbage at some fast food joint, throw it on the table, no nutritional value for the kids. The mother is always trying to catch up with housework and stuff because she works, you know, in an office environment or wherever. And by the time America's, you know, husband and wife couple finally get wind down at 9 o'clock at night, the last thing that they want to do is sit and listen to something so dry as the central bank or, you know, KL00. It doesn't touch their comfort zone. They do not and cannot realize the very danger that is facing America today and how close we are to the utter collapse, not just of our economy, but of our social structure, our political structure. They don't see it. Very few people see it. But I pointed out on this radio show today that President Andrew Jackson, one of my favorite presidents, said that one man with courage makes a majority.
Isn't that a wonderful statement?
It is.
One man with courage makes a majority.
Makes a majority because great things in history have never been done by the majority. It's always been done by a core, dedicated group of individuals who stay focused on the prize. And that's the way it was for the founding fathers. They faced great obstacles. And I gave the little story today about Jody Waters, who lives 40 miles south of me in Lodi, California. 8 years ago, this woman stumbled upon the MTBE gasoline issue. And I know that you're familiar with this, but when she first started raising the issue of how toxic this stuff was, the newspapers ripped this woman apart. It did not deter her, despite her personal household problems of a divorce and four teenagers and her house getting flooded out. She was relentless. And the bottom line, after two rallies at the state capitol, by the end of this year, all MTBE in all gas in the United States of America will be gone. And it's a tremendous story. Somebody should make another Aaron Brockovich movie on Jody Waters. But one woman has removed a gas additive throughout the United States of America. One person. Her story is remarkable. So if people out there think that one person can't make a difference, that isn't true. Just look at Jesus.
Well, what we need are more people like that. And, of course, they're emphasizing one specific issue. I have to cover everything. You cover an awful lot of things. But I think really one of the great issues we have today is water fluoridation, which is aimed at dumbing down our children. Actually decreasing the sexual urge. It lowers testosterone. It creates lower fertility rates in animals and in human beings. It modifies behavior. It creates cancer. It increases bone fragility. And if we keep hammering away at this, eventually people are going to understand they've been lied to by their doctors. They've been lied to by their dentists. They've been lied to by the public health service. They've been lied to by government officials. And it's about time they started protecting themselves. Because if they don't, nobody's going to protect them.
And it's funny that you bring that up, because one of the discs that I just sent to one of my webmasters, one of the files that I created, it's about 73 pages, is on that. And I'm waiting for Jay to get it posted to my website in the reading room so I can do a column on it. It's about 73 pages long on fluoride. And it's the most incredible story, really.
How they're able to sell this to the American people for 50 years, and then we wonder why our kids can't learn in school and why they can't compete with children from other countries, you know, throughout the world after they graduate from high school. And I'll tell you, because they've intensely dumbed down our children, not only with fluoride, but, of course, with aspartame and mercury and with other things. But those are the three major poisons that they're poisoning our children with. And where's the outcry from the mothers?
Well, because they don't have the ammunition. But that's why I'm going to write this column, because the documents that I have go back and absolutely prove that the Germans gave it to prisoners to make them passive,
Is that the Perkins letter, or what do you have?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember, Stan.
How can I get a copy of that? Because I need a copy of that.
Yeah, well, it's going to be posted on my website, but this is one of the most incredible sets of research I've seen. And, you know, back in 1993, I had all of the metal fillings, because I'll be 56 in July, but I had all the metal fillings taken out of my mouth and my daughter's mouth, and I spent a fortune putting gold in our mouths. At that point, I've been on bottled water since I was 18 years old. Don't ask me why, but I've never drank tap water. But
maybe that's why you're as smart as you are.
But I had the fillings taken out of our mouth, and from that point on, I've had our dentists don't use any fluoridated products on us. I use natural toothpaste, all of that stuff. But when I have had these documents, like I said, for like 14 years, and fluoride is one of the key issues as to why the American people have become so passive. That and a lot of other things, of course. But you're right. Aspartame, fluoride, and
mercury
are big, big deals.
And I think it's so important that we provide the information. So I encourage people to get that information from DV. But DV, when you have it on your website, will you let me know? Because I'm putting together a syllabus that I want to make available all across America.
Yeah.
And I will, of course, refer them to your website, but I would like to see what you have. Actually, the Russians use this in the prison camps and the gulag. Hitler would not use this on the German people for it ate their water, but in the occupied territories he would, according to a Mr. Perkins. And this Mr. Perkins is set up by our government right after the Second World War to evaluate what I.G. Farben was up to, and of course he wrote back, and you'll find a reference to Mr. Perkins up on the internet in a wonderful book we have written in 1957 by Swinburne Clyburn, an answer to Bertrand Russell's book. It was entitled The Impact of Science on Society, written in 53. Clyburn wrote a book in 57 called The Aids of Treason. The Aids of Treason, which, of course, is what it's all about. It is treason against God, against our people, and they're intentionally poisoning our children.
Yeah, and I've written about this before, that one of the most important things that the American people can do is to get themselves healthy, because you cannot be an effective freedom fighter if you're spending all of your time in emergency rooms at the doctors. My parents in their late 70s, and of course, they've been shell-shocked by what I've presented to them for all these years. And you know, my mom, she has, you know, shaking and shaking and shaking. And she was very, very angry a few years ago when I told her all about aspartame and everything. And because she's always used NutraSweet and all of that stuff. And I don't think I've consumed 6 soft drinks in my entire life, because I am one of those people that was born without a sweet tooth. I don't like anything with sugar. I don't like, you know, diet soft drinks. I don't drink any of that stuff. But my mom was very, very angry, because she now believes firmly that her condition has been caused because of NutraSweet.
Does she have Parkinson's?
No, she does not have Parkinson's, but she shakes and stuff. But she, like I said, she's used NutraSweet since it came on the market.
Well, it was known, you know, back in the early 70s, before this was ever legalized and allowed by the FDA under the pressure from that great American patriot, Donald Rumsfeld, the CEO of Cereal. But it was known that it produced lesions in the brains of animals. And, of course, it never should have been legalized. And the people in the FDA fought its legalization for almost 15 years. And yet, of course, it is there now, and nothing's being done to bring the truth to the American people. And the only way, of course, we're going to do anything is lawsuits. And that's why they passed this legislation this last week, to prevent lawsuits in state courts so they could tie them up in federal courts, so there will be no recourse, and so the American people will never hear the truth about how they're being poisoned by Monsanto and the other countries that are cereal. Of course, they sold it to Monsanto. But, of course, what is NutraSweet? Why, it's made up of methyl alcohol, which is a deadly poison, aspartic acid, which is a deadly poison, and phenylalanine, which is a poison for the brain in large quantities. And so what are we doing? We're giving it out of the American people. We're going to be back in just a moment with DB Kid and wrap up this evening's program. And you're saying this could be true. Well, why don't you, of course, begin checking our website, get the information we have, and then go up on the internet. You'll find all sorts of articles there that will verify everything we're saying. But, of course, they don't want you to know. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is D.V. Kidd. Oh, D.V., you've got 3 minutes to wrap up this evening's program for us.
It's always a pleasure to be on your program. To wrap up, as always, it goes back to the same problem. The people who are serving in elected offices throughout the country are destroying this country, and the only way that we're going to take it back is if the American people themselves participate in their own government. That means taking back our country county by county, elected office by elected office. Freedom is not a spectator sport. And in my last article, or a couple articles ago on News with Views, and now it's up on my website, is called Excuses, because I get more excuses in my mailbox than Jimmy Carter has peanuts. And if we have people who are qualified to be sheriffs, we need them to run for office in the next election. We need people to run for the state legislature. We need to get these people out of office that are destroying this country. Otherwise, the same thing is going to continue to go on, and we quite honestly don't have that much time left. In my opinion.
I agree with you totally. In the name of fighting terrorism, you know, here we've got the 6'6" tall Marfan's fellow named Osama bin Laden, who has to travel with a kidney dialysis unit, if he's still alive. We don't know. All we know is what our government tells us, but they can't find this man. I mean, how do you have a kidney dialysis unit, you know, and you're 6 foot 6 inches tall, and we've got people who can read a newspaper from outer space by the satellite technology we have, but they can't find Osama bin Laden?
Oh, it's such an insult to the American people. But one of the things I brought out on that radio show today is that back in the mid-90s after Waco, the government conducted a huge propaganda campaign about the so-called militia movement in the United States, and by their own admission, they estimated that the militia movement, or people in the Take Back America, was between 12 and 14 million. Now, that was 10 years ago. I maintain that this movement in the United States is way bigger than that, that there are more people out there that know the truth. They simply haven't, they are not organized, they're not unified. They are not on the same sheet of music.
And I fear, DV, that many of our organizations are being led by the other side. And, of course, they're trying to get these people off on all sorts of side issues. Oh, hate the Catholics, hate the Jews, hate the Christians.
Well, look what happened in Placerville, California this last weekend. You had Christians who were demonstrating and have been for several months out in Placerville, who were carrying signs and put them on their big trucks that said homosexuality is a sin. And so the mayor of Placerville decided to declare the city of Placerville as a hate-free zone. As a matter of fact, that's my new article I just sent over to WorldNet Daily. It'll be up on Friday. Oops, we're out of time.
Well, DV Kidd, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure.
Good night. God bless.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation with DV. I know I always do. She's got a tremendous amount of spirit, a tremendous amount of dedication, a tremendous amount of information. And you want to go to her website. It's dv.com. That's dv.com. Get her information. She's got a lot of great information out there. And then spread this to other people. Well, this is the time I certainly want to mention that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there listening, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And if you want to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, to get a free copy of our newsletter, let me suggest our November newsletter, because that gives you the true story of fluoride and how it's being used to poison your children and choice poison your grandchildren. And we give you all the sources of reference for everything we say. We're not going to tell you where it is. We can, of course, see you can get William Hersey's testimony of a former Senate back in the year 2000. He's a scientist who works for the EPA testing water, and he'll tell you they're poisoning you. That's the December newsletter. We'll send you either the November or the December newsletter. The suppressed Senate testimony of Dr. William Hersey. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We carry, of course, Rescue 007 by Bert Schlossberg, whose father-in-law was on the plane. He believes he's still alive somewhere in a gulag prison, known to our government and to the Russians, but, of course, not known to the American people. We carry the top secret reports from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on 007. We have a 4-tape set on 007 because we want to keep this matter alive, and we hope you will as well. And then, of course, we mentioned that we republishing our book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and if you'd be interested in getting a case of those books, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Now, you'll never find such a good situation again, at least not until we publish the book many years in the future. But what a wonderful opportunity to have a case of the book, 62 books. And, of course, then you can give them out. You can afford to give them out. You can afford to distribute them as gifts. But the important thing is people who read this book, many times it will change their life. So remember, that's Brotherhood of Darkness, and you get a case of them. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then seriously consider getting my video, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or the tape by the same name. And also you should see my video. It's entitled Iraq, the Untold Story, and there's a syllabus that comes with that that explains to you that all of the wars of the last century, including the current war in Iraq, have been contrived and fought for far different reasons than the young men who were sent overseas to fight and bleed and suffer and die would ever understand. That's Iraq, the Untold Story, the video, syllabus. And then, of course, if you have not yet seen the video, they sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, or the 10-hour version. You need to get it, and you need to show it to your children, your grandchildren. And, of course, the videos, Megiddo 1, which is goes into biblical prophecy, Megiddo 2, which is the story of civilization, and I'm in that one, not very important, but we introduce you to Helena Petrovna Blavatsky and the Georgia Guidestones. What we need, of course, is these are very, very professionally done. Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, they sold their souls for rock and roll. Well, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you want to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, November, December, January, give us a call, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until Thursday, when we'll be back with you again in the evening, while Freedom of 21 will be here tomorrow. Until Thursday, may the Lord be with you.